tonight on Arena. Gavin Ring on La Boheme and Cathair Sivéan, and Fly Me to the Moon, Long Legs and The Commandant's Shadows are our films for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch us live on rte.ie/arena. It's film review night and I'm joined by reviewers Tara Brady and Hilary White. Before we get to this week's fare, let's remember Shelley Duvall. The death has been announced today of the American actress, best known for her work in Stanley Kubrick's Stephen King adaptation of The Shining. Here is that famous scene. Shelley is the one screaming.
Little pigs, let me come in. Not by the hair on your chinny chin chin. Then I'll huff, and I'll puff, and I'll blow your house in. Here's Johnny.
Shelley Duvall there as Wendy Torrance being attacked by her unhinged understatement of the year husband Jack in The Shining, played by Jack Nicholson. Hilary, can you recall some of her most memorable work?
Well, I mean, obviously The Shining is the one that secured her a place in cinema history, and her performance in that is... It's incredible for the fact that it was such a grueling film shoot, and Kubrick was famously abusive to her, and he shot the film chronologically. So by the time you get to the business end of that film, she is actually fatigued and worn down by what conditions were like on set.
Her most expressive face.
Yeah, and her physicality was incredible. She's this kind of willowy, lithe sort of figure, and you know, her eyes are almost sort of popping out of her head by the end of it, and she's very gaunt and pale. Robert Altman discovered her. And I think she's working at a publishing house or something like that, and he discovered her. And he cast her in a number of films. Nashville was probably the most famous one that she did with him. But of course, then she turned up as Olive Oil in a Popeye live action shoot they did. And a film called Three Women, for which she got a BAFTA nomination as well. So, you know, she had the chops. And of course, then just to look at, she is the enduring image of that film, The Shining. She's the face that we think of.
Well, I hope that means that we're going to be seeing lots of that work in the coming, which yeah. usually happens when somebody leaves us. Mm. Now, back to tonight's film reviews. We are back in the Technicolor world of the 1960s America. Fly Me to the Moon is a romantic comedy slash drama starring Scarlett Johansson and Chatham Tatum. A warring loving couple who disagree about the space race should or should not be sold to the public. Long Legs features Nicolas Cage as a satanic mass murderer looking for victims who were born on the 14th of any month. Cage's Long Legs promises to haunt your dreams long after the credits roll. And finally, The Commandant's Shadow, which can be seen as a companion piece to Jonathan Glazer's feature film Zone of Interest. It's a documentary where the son and grandson of Rudolf Hoss, the commandant of Auschwitz concentration camp, returned to Hoss's home and the concentration camp, which was just over the garden wall. As I said, Tara Brady and Hilary White are here. First, let's get tonight off to a flying start, Tara. We're in 60s America, the space race is on, but those in charge think it needs a PR boost. So they get this woman, Kelly Jones, mm-hmm. to do a PR job.
Indeed they do, and she is incredibly crass and blunt in what she's doing, and she's working for this shadowy Nixon apparatchik played by Woody Harrelson, who, being Woody Harrelson, always kind of steals the scenes that he's in and provides kind of one of the brightest spots in the film. And theoretically, this should be like a great sort of rat-a-tat-tat romantic screwball comedy, because you have this very straight-laced and grounded astronaut. He's flown 52 missions in Korea, we're told. He takes the fatalities of Apollo 1 very, very seriously. He takes he takes all of his responsibilities very, very seriously, and he has no time for all all the frivolity of having astronauts posing with watches and all this sort of thing.
And this is what she wants. This is her kind of PR plan.
Indeed. And as well as that, you have these two movie stars, like these two great movie stars who could have been movie stars in that era. They have that really kind of old school, like 60s kind of charm about them. They could have been movie stars in the era when that Mad Men, for example, is set. So everything is sort of set up and in place, but it doesn't ever really, really take off, which is a terrible thing when you've got a film that's based around a mission.
And we're talking about the Neil Armstrong.
We're talking about the lunar mission. So this becomes a big fundamental problem, because the film that they're making about the lunar mission is a film that we've seen a million times before, and we've seen it much better, most recently, for example, in First Man, and that is completely at loggerheads with the romantic side of the script, which they never really find a way to merge those two things into kind of a satisfactory movie. And you end up instead with all these kind of lulls and these kind of forgettable scenes. And you also have a script that doesn't really give enough material to the two leads to sort of bounce off each other.
So is there chemistry between the two leads, Hilary? Which I guess is very important if it's a rom-com.
It's absolutely essential. It's fundamental. But not for my money, there isn't. I mean, Scarlett Johansson can do this kind of thing in her sleep. You know, the Madison Avenue machine who comes in and she's snapping her fingers and she has the assistant beside her. But Channing Tatum, for me, I thought he looked wooden. I thought he looked disinterested. And he, in fact, like he seems so sort of dull screen presence that they have to dress him in these kind of primary coloured sweaters all the time to make him stand out in the control room beside all these kind of geeks with shirt sleeves and ties and things like that. And I think without that, you don't really have an anchor for the entire thing. I mean, there is a nice film lurking somewhere under the surface in this. But as Tara was saying, the ratios between deferential Apollo 11 homage and screwball 60s comedies, they're off. You know?
Okay, well, let's have a clip so we can gauge if there is charisma or not. Here, Kelly Jones, played by Scarlett Johansson, is pitching various marketing ideas to the very unconvinced Apollo 11 mission leader, Cole Davis, played by Channing Tatum.
Omega.
Look, this isn't Madison Avenue. We don't pay for this stuff.
No, it's cost-free. The brands get a tie-in money can't buy, and NASA works its way into the minds of everyday people.
A watch ad? That's your big idea?
Ready? Mm-hmm. Toothpaste? Tang! The energy breakfast drink chosen for Apollo astronauts on their trip to the moon.
Moon coupons.
But my personal favorite? Fruit of the Loom, right? The guy's got to wear something under those big suits, don't they?
NASA, like Fruit of the Loom. Look, I am not turning this ship into a flying billboard, no matter how much you want it to happen. And by the way, we don't have time to test all this before liftoff.
We don't have to send any of this up into space as long as we say it went.
Oh, so you're going
to
lie.
It's called selling. We're not lying to the customer. We're changing the way they think.
No, it's called lying.
Channing Tatum there as Cole Davis and Scarlett Johansson as Kelly Jones. So we've heard the conspiracy theories, Tara, of the fake moon landings. Does the film touch on that? Because there is a filmed moon landing.
It does, but I don't think it'll sort of please either side of that particular debate, I suppose, if we can even call it a debate. So one of the things that the film sets up, and it's a source of conflict between the two leads, and again, a source of conflict that sort of fails to ignite any kind of sparks or blaze up the screen. But a big source of conflict is that she is filming on a soundstage a backup moon mission just in case everything goes wrong with the camera on the Apollo spacecraft. So, and then he finds out about it, and so this becomes a sort of a secret, and then a source of tension.
So it's just a bit of plot rather than something serious.
It's just a bit of kind of fluffy pop kind of plot that's just been kind of parachuted into the film, and it doesn't really amount to much. Honestly, it was so forgettable. I was doing shopping lists while I was watching it.
What about you, Hilary? Worth seeing?
I think it's just sort of, it's annoying that this wasn't better, because I mean the raw materials are there for, you know, a very nice fluffy piece of romantic comedy set in a very engaging, charismatic historical context, but they just don't pull it off.
You know? Okay, stars out of five from you, Hilary.
2.5, 3.
2.5, 3. Okay, you can't even make up your mind. Yeah, Tara.
I don't think I can go above 2, but I did like the jumpers. I did like the pastel jumpers.
So that's watch it for the jumpers, if nothing else. That's for Fly Me to the Moon. Now for the Nicolas Cage. Fans, listen up. We covered the post-apocalyptic sci-fi Arcadian on Film Reviews a few weeks ago, where Cage played a father of two to fight to protect his sons from attack in an end of days world. He's back this time as a satanic mass murderer in long legs. Hilary, bring us into this.
So we are in a very wintry, bleak America, the kind of America you see in the backdrop of films like Silence of the Lambs or Prisoners. And here in Oregon, it's the 1990s, we have Agent Lee Harker, played by Micah Monroe, who listeners will know from a very good horror film a few years ago called It Follows. She is a rookie just out of the academy, and her first assignment is a grisly serial killer case which is haunting Oregon. And we find out very early on that she has some kind of telepathic ability, and she is able to pick up sort of psychic wavelengths. What we know about the killer is that these are murder suicides that are found in family homes, and there's no forensic trace of the killer bar a strange occult alphabet that they find, a handwritten one.
Oh, right. Yeah. And but we do know the killer is Nicolas Cage.
We do. We see him early, and we see him slightly out of his head is cut off of the shot. And it's emblematic of one of the things that's absolutely great about this film. Osgood Perkins, who was a very, very good horror pedigree, is Anthony Perkins from Psycho's son for a start. But he's also made
Norman Bates'
yeah,
son.
Yeah. So he's also made several really, really interesting horror films to date. But one of the things that he does is he plays around with framing, and he plays around with geometric shapes, and it creates this sort of oppressive thing of deja vu. You keep seeing triangles everywhere, and then that reflects the sort of weird satanic script that you're seeing as well. There's some really great shots where you just have, you know, you have like Micah Monroe is sitting there, and there's a huge space behind her, so you're just primed, waiting for something to come into the frame to sneak up on her. So he's really, really great at the design of the film is really great, and the sound design as well is really, really exemplary. Like it's like a really brilliantly crafted horror all the way to the final reel.
Oh, and then
it's one of those films, and it's a bit of a disease with modern horror is that when you get the big explanation, you're like, oh, I rather when I didn't know things, and the more it tries to explain itself, the sort of more of a muddle it gets.
So let's have a clip here. Micah Monroe's character, FBI agent Lee Harker, and her on-screen mother, played by Elisa Witt, asks her about her religious devotion or lack thereof.
Will you tell me the honest truth about something?
I'll try.
Do you still say your prayers?
No, Mom. I never said my prayers, never once. They scared me. What's so funny?
You're right. No, our prayers don't help us. Prayers don't do a goddamn thing.
So that sounds very bleak, Hilary. Mm. Prayers don't do anything. What's going to help them?
So this is essentially a vampire film that has a police procedural spin on it. So we have a female heroine who is psychically linked to a malevolent threat that must be invited inside the house before it can take you out. And her surname is Harker. So the raw materials or the fundaments are fairly obvious.
And what's the thing about the 14th?
So we're into sort of numerology, which is kind of one of these sort of trope things that's associated with Satanism.
Oh, right. So he kills people whose birthday is on the 14th of any month.
This is figured out. There's a length. And lo and behold, spoiler alert, our detective who is hunting him also has this date. Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So cue lots of angry emails now to RT. But it is, you're talking there about sort of Nicolas Cage being revealed like literally in the opening seconds of the film. And then there comes a point about two-thirds of the way into this film where he's really revealed, and we see him going to the hardware store, we see him creeping out the girl at the till, and we see his house.
And does he look like Nicolas Cage?
He doesn't, no. There's a lot of prosthetics on. He's big blonde tassel-haired wig. And he's got like Lou Reed and Mark Bolan posters in his basement and a guitar set up to play. And it just starts to kind of wind down the whole thing. All this wonderful tension that is brewed in the opening 50 minutes or so. This really lovely, thick, eerie, sensual kind of atmosphere just starts to kind of fizzle out. And by the time that we're in the end of it, where we should begin the payoff, as Tara said, it's preposterous even within the rules that this film has set out for itself. Even within, you know, a film that has a lot of paranormal elements to it, you're looking at the ending and you're going, hang on a sec, that isn't going to do it.
So yeah. Are you blaming Young Perkins for this, the director, or is it a script problem?
Well, he's both writer and director. I mean, the thing is I think there's enough atmosphere that it carries the film over the line, still makes it a really interesting thing.
I think it doesn't undo that good stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't override it. But there's so many like really clever little references. Like, you know, there's this a tiny little reference to Bundy, and there's a little reference. There's definitely a reference to Zodiac Killer, and then there's a reference to Rosemary's Baby with the red, and there's all these little things threaded through, but at the end of the day you sort of wish that you were watching the film that it started out being, which was more closer to something like David Fincher's Seven. Than when it goes kind of big into the mythology and has, you know, all these, well, you know, there's something about
it does sound intriguing though.
Yes, no, it's certainly that. It's certainly intriguing, and I would recommend it, despite the fact it goes a little bit off the rails.
Okay, stars out of five for you, Tara.
I go four.
Four, and that's pretty good. And for you, Valerie?
My indecisive demeanour holds fast. 3.5/4.
3.5/4. That's pretty good for something that doesn't quite come off in the end. Yeah. To close our film reviews for the evening, The Covenant's Shadow, it's a feature documentary that tells the story of a generation after the atrocities of World War II's death camps. We meet the son of Auschwitz commandant Rudolf Hoss and Holocaust survivor 96-year-old Anita Lasker Wolfisch. The unnerving domesticity of the Hoss family, who live beside Auschwitz concentration camp, was fictionalized in Jonathan Glazer's The Zone of Interest. But Hilary, this is the real thing. This is a revisit by Hoss's son and Hoss's grandson.
Yeah. So we are back to the real life setting of one of the most talked about films of the last 10 years, and some would say one of the most important Holocaust films, you know, in the long, illustrious canon of that genre. Danielle Volker takes us both sides of that partition wall. She introduced us to the 87-year-old son of Rudolf Hoss, Hans Jürgen is his name, and his son Kai, who is a pastor in southern Germany. And then on the other side, as you said, we meet Anita Lasker-Wolfisch, who was a cellist in an orchestra that played in Auschwitz, which itself is an amazing story and one that is asking of a documentary made about it. I think there was a dramatic film. Did Arthur Miller do it? Dramatic film about that. And so we have these two journeys, for want of a better word, happening side by side. But even that's kind of too simplistic a word to use for a film that isn't going to give you any easy resolutions or easy answers to a very thorny, very knotty historic case. And there's a chasm between this woman, Anita Lasker-Wolfisch, who's in her mid-90s. There's a chasm between her and everybody else in the film, because in the Viktor Frankl thing of man's search for meaning, it's only the man inside really knows and can ever know. And that in itself means that it's not an easy, neat film.
Okay, well, let's take a clip of it, and we're with the Hoss family in this. We travel to southern Germany to the home of Hans Jürgen Hoss and his son Kai, and Kai is an English speaker, and he grapples with the idea that his father grew up beyond the wall where mass murder took place next door in Auschwitz.
I mean, it freaks me a little bit when you think about, like, there's this, you know, this joyful family life going on with, you know, actually quite beautiful presence and joy, fun, having toys and enjoying life, and then just a couple of hundred yards behind the walls, you know, barbed wire walls, there'd be, you know, people being murdered. That is just mind-blowing when you think about it.
That is Kai there, the son of Hans-Jürgen Haas. So Tara, like those of us who have seen Zone of Interest, where we're thinking about, you know, that family home, the domesticity of the Haas home, and then the wall, and we see the ovens and the smoke coming from the ovens. Do you get that kind of... Do you get that picture? Are you in the house, and then are you in the concentration camp?
Well, if you didn't appreciate Glazer's film before, you will. I mean, the level of detail that like you couldn't possibly until you're looking at like photographs in this film, and it's so uncanny that you think that you're looking at stills from Zone of Interest. Like what the recreation he did is so uncanny, and also the life that Hans-Jürgen talks about, and how oblivious he was as a boy. And he gets this like really exciting looking boy sized toy airplane, and it was made by the prisoners, and he never really questioned it. There's a whole bunch of interesting dimensions to this. I mean, the two older people are on very, very different journeys. I think there's some sense that Hans-Jürgen is on a journey. He does have to reckon with things that he has either suppressed or just didn't know because he was too young.
And we meet his sister, don't we, who has
his sister is really quite chilling. His sister like literally comes out with a line to the effect of, I don't know how dad must have been a very strong man to do what he did. And she's talking about the fact that he oversaw the death of like over a million of people. I'll never be angry with him. And that's that moment, I felt like my heart was stopping during that. It was really kind of quite chilling. And I just wanted her to stop talking. It was just more than I could kind of bear.
But her brother is trying to get some resolution.
Yes, her brother is trying to. But as Hilary said, there's no big moment of catharsis where everyone hugs or anything in this film. And like Anita, like you know, who's now in her 90s, there's no sense of journey with her whatsoever. I mean, it's far more about her daughter's trauma, and her daughter is a psychotherapist, Maya, and she's written this book about intergenerational trauma that specializes in children of Holocaust survivors and how that imprinted upon them growing up. And it is clearly something that she can't let go of, because her mother, who's never set foot in Germany, moved to Britain after the war, after she survived, and has obviously never gone back. But the daughter, Maya, has chosen to live in Germany. So you get these senses.
There's a scene where Maya tries to ask the mother to come to Auschwitz and have the reunion there with these members of the Haas family, and you see she's just like, have no time for that idea whatsoever. She's like, I have an Auschwitz in my head and that's it.
And what is the meeting like when it finally happens?
It's kind of awkward and underwhelming, and you know, they're just this two parties sort of shrugging at each other and saying, well, you know, what's done is done, and maybe we just all move forward and try to make sure this doesn't happen again. But of course, it never stopped happening. So there's a coldness in this film. It's not a film that's going to sort of illuminate things really that much more for you. And it makes you think about the difference between dramatic filmmaking and documentary filmmaking. And maybe documentary filmmaking is almost inadequate for something like this, you know?
And I think as well, Anita, there's no change in her. She, like, all the way through, she's just, like, traumatized. You didn't live through this. Mm. Like, get on with it. Get on with your life. Yeah. And she doesn't move at all from that. Yeah. So there's never going to be any big hug at the end. This is how she has survived. Yeah. And, you know, she survived something completely unimaginable.
Okay, so stars out of five for you, Tara.
Four.
Four. And from you?
Four for me.
Okay, so that's four stars each for The Commandant's Shadow. The other two movies are Long Legs and Fly Me to the Moon. Tara Brady and Hilary White, thank you so much. Ever since it premiered in 1896 in Turin, Puccini's La Bohème remains one of the most famous and popular operas in the canon. It tells the doomed love affair of Mimi and Rodolfo, a poor seamstress and a poet, just two of the Bohemians portrayed trying to survive in the poverty of Paris in the mid-19th century. Now tenor Gavin Ring is bringing it to his hometown of Carhaix-Saint-Vien with a little help from Cork Opera House. I'm delighted that Gavin Ring, who plays Rodolfo, and Rory Dunn, who plays Colline, are with me in studio. So, Gavin, I will ask you why You're bringing it to Cara Syvene in a moment, but let's start with music. You've been busy recording and you have recorded yourself as a tenor. Your little hand is, your tiny hand is frozen. So that's the opening
aria. So it's Rodolfo's big aria, I suppose, and one of the most iconic moments of La Bohème. And
is he throwing her a line?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's throwing her his best chat up lines here. This is him meeting Mimi for the first time, and of course he falls head over heels in love with her, and he starts rolling out the chat up lines like there's no tomorrow. Now, look, I suppose I'm not doing him enough credit because the poetry that he spins is sublime. But yeah, so this is it's as I say, one of the most iconic moments in the opera. It's one of the most iconic moments in opera itself, really. So yeah, it's pretty something.
And this is you singing.
Indeed.
There's Gavin Ring. Live, you were singing live with the National Symphony Orchestra of Ireland there. That's pretty impressive, Gavin.
By the great Puccio Din.
Oh, beautiful. So, Gavin, you decided then that you wanted, when you were a boy, maybe a 16-year-old.
That's right.
Was that it? In Cara Syvene. And where were you that you decided, I am going to bring grand opera here?
Well, it's always been a dream of mine to bring opera to Cara Syvene, and I've been doing it in various iterations over the years. And as you alluded to there, when I was 16 years old, I put my first concert on at the Cara Syvene Music and Arts Festival. The chairman at the time, a gentleman by the name of John O'Connor, he said, you know, how would you feel about doing a concert? I was getting a reputation at the time for spinning a few tunes, as it were. And I said, I'd love to. He says, well, you know, you'd probably need to organise it yourself. So I said, fair enough. Kind of just went at it and put on this concert. It was wonderful. And I suppose from then on, I've had an association with the festival over the years where we've done various concerts like that. We've had the Contemporary Quartet. We had the Irish National Opera Gala in 2018. And I felt the momentum was building towards bringing a full-scale operatic experience to Cara Syvene. And when I was a part of the Cara O'Sullivan Associate Artist Programme with Cork Opera House during the pandemic as well in 2021, we devised and performed in a series of operas, or rather John O'Brien and Conor Hanratty devised the operas and we performed in them throughout Cork City during the pandemic. And they were, I suppose, they were devised in such a way as that they could be done outdoors in site-specific areas and all of that. So they were imminently malleable. And And I suppose the cornerstone of the, of those performances was a performance of La Boheme, which we did then in its entirety in 2022. Still holding true to the core concept, of course, of having a narrator, which we have in Carsevine again, played by the wonderful actor Aidan O'Donoghue. But I felt that this would be perfect. This would be the perfect movement forward in terms of bringing opera to Carsevine. And I put it to Eileen Gleeson, wonderful Kerry woman, CEO of Cork Opera House, how she might feel about partnering up, and the rest is history.
And now, you said the Cara O'Sullivan Associate Artists Programme. Now, you were a member of the first group.
Yes.
And Rory, you're a member of the second group.
Yes, I'm the current one. So it's a 2-year cycle, I believe. And we're currently, so we would have, as a group, put on a similar production to La Boheme that we did in 2022. Last year, we put on, our start of this year, I should say, we put on Carmen by Bizet with a narrator and a reduced version. And
yes, I think the last time you were in with us, you sang from Carmen.
Exactly, yeah, you're dead right, I did indeed. So that was, it's been a wonderful opportunity through Cork Opera House to get to air all these different roles that we wanted to do, and to bring it to Cork as well, because people are so enthusiastic. Yeah.
And now Gavin explained the wonderful love affair between Rodolfo and Mimi, but there is this wonderful group, this milieu of artists, and one, you're a philosopher, is that right?
Not personally, but yeah, the character certainly is.
Yes,
Kalina.
He's able to philosophize, let me tell you. He's brilliant.
Maybe, yes.
So this is the whole group. They're penniless, but they're optimistic.
Yes, absolutely.
At the beginning, anyway.
Yeah, it starts off very much. There's sprinklings throughout the opera where, especially the four guys living in this apartment, and you know, there's always a buzz of excitement with them where they're running out of fuel and they decide to burn one of the plays one of them has written because they've no wood for the fire. Exactly. Obviously not the best literature in the world. And then there's a lot of like play acting and fighting and this joviality that kind of goes through the whole thing. And then obviously this, I think, builds and is why it's such an effective opera, and why the tragedy in it is so effective, that the comedy and the joviality carries this serious theme throughout the core of the piece, and then you get to the end and it's just the most devastating thing on earth.
It's a terrible tragedy at the end, and you try and help the situation. Mimi isn't well,
exactly,
say that. And you do a great thing, you make a great sacrifice.
Well, yes, it's so the Cotari, as it's called, is kind of Colline's little moment to shine near the end of the fourth act, where Mimi is unwell and medicine needs to be bought, and he decides that he'd sell his winter coat, his only possession, and sings an aria where he bids farewell to the coat and kind of thanks it for being so warm to him and everything like that. But of course it's all really directed at Mimi, who he's so fond of, but has always kind of kept at arm's length throughout the show, because he's trying to be this intellect of sorts that never really materializes for him, because they're all just young people struggling in a big city at the time.
Okay, now this recording was not with the National Symphony Orchestra. This was in a room with a piano in Wexford, but this is wonderful. This is Rory Don and that Cote aria. So that is the Cote aria sung there by Rory Don as Colline from La Boheme. So, Gavin, you're going to be in the Daniel O'Connell Memorial Church in Carrigsaveen. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a full cast And then you said an orchestra of 32.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have we're obviously, because this is the Cork Opera House production of La Boheme, that means we get to transport Cork Opera House down to Carra Savine, and that includes the orchestra. So we have the Cork Opera House Concert Orchestra with us, conducted by John O'Brien. So it's the full throttle operatic experience in the west of Ireland. And I think the only way to describe the motivation to bring something as big as that down to South Kerry is having the pure cheek to do it.
I thought you were going to say madness, but cheek is just as good. Yeah.
Well, yeah, a sprinkling of madness as well, I suppose. So it's hugely exciting, massively exciting. And, you know, myself and Rory here, we can't wait to get chomping at the bit, as it were.
And you are singing in this. What does it mean to you to sing Puccini?
I mean, Puccini is the best to sing, really. I mean, he's like Verdi, I suppose, in a way. They really knew how to write for voice. So they do an awful lot of the work for you. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have to work hard, but in the way that they spin these gorgeous, beautiful, mellifluous lines of Italian ed verismo opera, it's just the most fantastic music to sing. Now, of course, you have to be up to the challenge. There's, you know, scaling the vocal heights which Puccini requires of you, and staying true at the same time to your theatrical character. That's the balancing act that any opera singer has to try and pull off, as it were. But I think we have a brilliant cast, myself and Rory, obviously, but with Rachel Croche, Brendan Collins, Emma Nash, and we've got David Howes as well, Malachy Frame, wonderful Northern Irish baritone, and then obviously we have our narrator, Aidan O'Donoghue. I think we have the ideal team to put in a performance for the ages of this incredible piece.
Performance of the ages. And for you, Puccini.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's like Gavin said, it's amazing, but for different reasons, I think, for me as a baritone, especially this sort of role. I mean, the two things I think for vocal writing that Puccini does incredibly well is these soaring, gorgeous melodies that sound easy to sing but are very not. Yes. But also he has a certain way of making conversation out of little interjections that everyone does. And I think a lot of Colline for me, and a lot of those supporting roles that you might have in this compared to other roles like Scarpia or Jenny Skeeky or anything like that, he knows how to create what seems like conversation in groups.
Yeah, and it never feels stunted or stilted. You know, the way sometimes in opera, sometimes you can get composers who don't necessarily get the interchange and conversation like that. I think Mozart was another genius at that with his recitatives. Absolutely, and things like that. But Puccini is absolutely the heir to that. You don't really feel like you're witnessing an opera. It feels utterly natural, you know. It's incredible.
Well, I think you've sold it. I think it sounds like not only an opera, but it sounds like an event. So it's Puccini's La Boheme in the Daniel O'Connell Memorial Church in Carra Savine. It's on Sunday, the 4th of August. Further details from corkoperahouse.ie. Rory and Gavin, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
From opera to Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead, the cult zombie comedy, which stars Simon Pegg and Nick Frost as two no-hopers navigating a zombie apocalypse in Britain, arrived in cinemas 20 years ago this year. Shaun of the Dead was inspired by ideas Pegg and director Edgar Wright used for their television sitcom Spaced, particularly an episode in which Pegg's character hallucinates a zombie invasion. The film also references The Night of the Living Dead, film by Giorgio Romero. Simon Pegg and director Edgar Wright were at Glastonbury Festival recently discussing the significance of the film and their trilogy of films that also includes Hot Fuzz and The World's End. And I'm delighted to be joined by John Maguire to have a look back at A Slice of Fried Gold, as Sean himself would say. So John, remind us of the plot of Shaun of the Dead.
Shaun of the Dead was Wright's second film. He'd made a feature film called A Fistful of Fingers that nobody had ever seen. But this was supposed to be his debut, like you say, Kay, after Spaced, which was a very popular sitcom that ran for two seasons on Channel 4. And like you say, they were casting around for an idea for a movie and they hit on this, let's do something with zombies, because they're both, Pegg and Frost, were co-wrote this film, Shaun of the Dead, and they were obsessed with the films of George A. Romero. I mean, Dawn of the Dead, Shaun of the Dead. And
is that what Spaced was like? They just
Spaced was a mix of cultural references, I suppose. At that time, I suppose in the noughties and the early noughties, popular culture had folded in on itself. So references to popular culture were picked up by everybody. And jokes were based on older jokes. It was a very kind of a Tarantino-esque kind of thing where the reference became the material, if you know what I mean. So they were casting around for an idea and they hit on this. And the send-up, I suppose, works in an unexpected way. This is the twist that they put on it when they were writing it. Instead of focusing on the zombies and looking for laughs there, the film treats the living characters as kind of sitcom regulars with histories and friendships and conflicts, and whose attempts to work these things out keep getting interrupted by the fact that the world has fallen apart. There's a flesh-eating apocalypse destroying London, destroying everything. And everybody's turned into this mob of the undead who are coming after them.
And it's so, a very suburban setting, isn't
it? It's very much a North London thing. Yeah, very much so. And it's about, I suppose, uneventful and aimless lives. Peg's character, Sean, is a London electronic salesman. So he's kind of a low-level retail. And he's going nowhere. And his roommate, who's played by Nick Frost, very well played by Nick Frost, who people would have known from Spaced, but this kind of made their career and their double act. He spends his time drinking in the pub and they smoke weed and play video games and they're just slackers, you know, they're kind of just hanging around. So something has to change, something has to happen in their lives. And Sean is in a relationship with a girlfriend called Liz, who's played by Kate Ashfield. He's got a mother played by Penelope Wilton. Kate's friend, Di, played by Lucy Davis, and Di's boyfriend, David, played by Dylan Moran, who gets a brilliant death. I mean, as an actor, Dylan Moran can be proud of the fact that he gets one of the great cinema deaths in Shaun of the Dead. So you've got the little group going together. They have to find safety, so they go to the Winchester
How do
pub.
They find out there's a zombie apocalypse and
It's very cleverly handled, actually, Kay. Sean goes to the shops and doesn't notice that the world has fallen apart and that the zombie apocalypse has happened. People are shuffling around. The place looks terrible. There's rubbish everywhere. There's a burning car. He doesn't notice it. It doesn't feel that totally different to him. And I suppose he needs to be woken up. He's kind of undead. He's in stasis and he needs to be woken up. And Liz, the girlfriend, very much wants him to cop on and get, you know, start living a life, because he's not a child. He's in his early 30s when the film is set. And that's really what it's about. It's about transforming. He becomes a hero. He's swinging his cricket bat. They have a siege mentality. They hit the pub and they try to, you know, live it
out. Yes, and there's this famous scene or famous plan. So the Shaun of the Dead has a plan. He's Simon Pegg and Ed is Nick Frost. They make a plan to deal with the zombie invasion. So we listen to it and then you can talk to us about it.
So, what's the plan?
Right. We take Pete's car, we drive over to Mum's, we go in, we take care of Philip.
I'm so sorry, Philip.
Then we grab Mum, we go over to Liz's place, pull up, have a cup of tea, and wait for all this to blow over.
Why have we got to go to Liz's?
Because we do.
But she dumped you.
I have to know if she's all right.
Why?
Because I love her.
All right, gay.
I'm not staying there, though.
Why not?
If we hole up, I want to be somewhere familiar, I want to know where the exits are, and I want to be allowed to smoke.
OK. Take Pete's car, go round Mum's, go in, deal with Philip.
Sorry, Philip.
Grab Mum, go to Liz's, pick her up, bring her back here, have a cup of tea, and wait for all this to blow over.
Perfect. No, 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 wait, we can't bring her back here.
Why not?
Well, it's not exactly safe, is it?
Yeah. The state of it.
Where's safe? Where's familiar?
Where can I smoke?
Take car, go to Mum's, kill Phil.
Sorry.
Grab Liz, go to the Winchester, have a nice cold pint, and wait for all this to blow over.
How's that for a slice of fried gold?
Yeah, boy!
That is so funny and so stupid at the same time.
That's the key to it, really, isn't it?
But if no we wonder look at Simon Pegg ended up in Mission Impossible with this planning.
It's a good plan. But if we look at how the couple at the centre of the film, which is Sean and Ed, not Sean and Liz, and they're still trying to make one another laugh, they're still dropping comedy catchphrases, they're still making movie references, they're still referencing individual movie lines. There's a Flavor Flav from Public Enemy reference in there. That it flies over your head, but it's so packed with references. It's the entire script is composed of little bits of pieces like magpies that they've picked up from stuff that they like.
And is that the fun of watching it as well, John?
I suppose it is. 20 years is a long time, Kay. And at that time, of course it's a parody. Of course it's a satire, really. But it's also a celebration of the things that they're taking the mickey out of. And the references do come thick and fast. Even before the film actually begins, under the Universal Studios revolving planet, that famous movie logo, Wright introduces a vibrating interference that comes directly from the soundtrack to Dawn of the Dead, Romero's original film. And it's all the way through it. Army of Darkness and American Werewolf in London, John Carpenter's entire oeuvre, Spielberg's Temple of Doom, The Deer Hunter, they all get big moments, they all get references, and it's folded together into this story. It's very cleverly done, really.
And there are loads of zombies, and the zombies were, I think, people that they just gave a pound to.
Fans of space. Mostly fans of space, yeah, and they kitted them out. Now, the effects work is cheap. This was a cheap film. It was made cheaply. So it's not really a horror movie. It's not really a splatter movie. But yeah, they got people that were fans to go down to London. They paid them a pound because they had to pay them something. They did them up and they shuffled around for.
So the you're talking about the importance of it, or what works in it is how the relationships revolve.
That's very much the message.
So they're all down the pub and the zombies are trying to break in. But I guess they learn how to work together, or is it they become heroes?
They become heroes. They become violent heroes. That's really the idea of it. Sean swings his cricket bat. They dispatch a guy, a zombie that manages to break in. They barricade the doors. And all of that stuff is directly referenced to the Romero films, that kind of mob mentality, which is the scariest thing about zombies, is that mindless mob mentality, that fear. And these guys that we've grown to love over the course of the film and find extremely funny, then subtly change into action hero stereotypes. And Wright, of course, and Pegg would go on then to make Hot Fuzz, which is entirely based on action movie stereotypes and, again, another satire. And a little after that, they made The World's End in this famous Cornetto trilogy. Which is about an alien invasion, like the invasion of the Body Snatchers.
And the reference to the Cornetto trilogy.
That is the Cornetto trilogy, yeah, those three films. They don't share a story.
Why is it Cornetto?
In each of the films, there's a passing reference to the Cornetto ice cream. And the three films were produced on a combined budget of about 30 million, but they went on to make about 150 million. But they remain kind of cult films. This is Wright's fundamental problem, is that he is a cult filmmaker. Now, a very good cult filmmaker, but he hasn't been able to transfer that over into more commercial cinema or American studio cinema.
I think we should play another clip.
Yeah,
this one, so Sean and Ed are being attacked by a zombie who came out of the shed, and they wonder if vinyl records might be a good weapon, but which ones to choose from their collection to do the murdering.
Now, some of these are limited.
What was that?
I think it was Blue Monday.
Man, there was an original presser.
For fuck's sake.
Purple Rain.
No.
Sign of the Times.
Definitely not.
The Batman soundtrack.
Throw it. Okay. Oh, Dire Straits.
Throw it.
Stone Roses.
No. Second coming.
I like it. Oh, Sade.
That's Liz's.
Yeah, but she did dump you.
Oh.
There's some girl in the shed.
They said it was locked.
That's another clip.
Reference.
It's such a reference, and it's such a lad thing, isn't it?
About
a vinyl collection. It's
Taking care of it, because Sean would have fancied himself as a bit of a DJ. But when we're drawing a line, a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about 30 years of Pulp Fiction and Tarantino, and we were talking about Tarantino-esque, which is this rash of films that came after Pulp Fiction. And this is very much one of them. It's the same kind of pacey, hip dialogue, self-reflexive references, movie homages, the whiplash camera work and attention-grabbing editing. You hear that sound when he whips the camera, who whips the editing, and we actually literally hear it. All of that is very much like it. But really, the greatest connection between himself and Tarantino is how Wright frames the world through incidental, everyday details. Even something like a zombie apocalypse or a serial killer in a small village or an alien invasion. All those stories are framed, these wild and dramatic stories are framed through absorbing and discussing everyday human behavior and interactions about culture and society, through brands and knickknacks and television and the stuff that's all around us, like Prince Records. And so it's a recognizably ordinary epic, if you know what I mean. These are very ordinary, everyday, recognizable and relatable characters.
And they were conscious decisions by Wright.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, the two of them are friends, Wright and Tarantino. Wright wrote and directed the best of the fake trailers that were in Tarantino's ill-fated, as it turns out, double bill with Robert Rodriguez, Grindhouse. He made one of those films, and they've collaborated over the years since then. But what's mostly interesting is how both filmmakers would cite a lot of the same filmmakers from throughout film history as influences. There's a sense throughout Shaun of the Dead and Wright's subsequent films that Tarantino's influence is also an influence, which leaves us with a very interesting situation where these films are kind of homages to homages. And that reflexive, that double helix really is very interesting. But, and I suppose it's a big but, Kay, Tarantino never made an outright romantic comedy, and Shaun of the Dead is a remarkably efficient example of that genre.
It works as well.
They publicised it at the time as the world's first rom-com. That was on the posters. Because that it really is a romance. And I suppose the message in the film is that, first of all, it's crazy how youthful this film is, how young the energy is in it. And it's the same fun buzz in Hot Fuzz, I suppose. And very much apparent later when Wright made an adaptation of Scott Pilgrim versus the World. But it's how fleeting the energy is, I suppose. At the core of it is a message that growing up is a bit of a nightmare and falling in love is another nightmare. But with the right woman and the right friends by your side, things might work out okay. And it's a good message.
It's a very good message. My thanks to John McGuire for looking back at Shaun of the Dead to mark its 20th anniversary. Thank you so much, John. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Barbara Rose Anmu and Paula Shields. Niall McMonagall was on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Nasa McLaughlin. John Creedon is next after the news at 8.